G'day you mob, welcome to this episode of Aussie English. Today I've got a special episode for you where I'm interviewing a young man named Harrison Warne. Now, Harrison creates documentary films. He's an ecologist and he got his degree in zoology and ecology at James Cook University in Townsville. I stumbled across his documentary Underfrog, one of his documentaries recently, and it sort of struck a chord for me because I'm very passionate about the Australian environment and wanting to control pest species in order to protect our wild environments here in Australia, right? We have massive issues with pest species like camels in the desert that are populating, you know, at ridiculous numbers and destroying infrastructure, endangering native animals, everything like that. We also have horses in the southeast of Australia, in the mountains there, along the Great Dividing Range. And so, Harrison had created a documentary about Kosciuszko National Park and covered some of these topics. He talked about the damage that the horses were causing in these parks and some of the rare and really charismatic Australian species that are now on the brink of extinction as a result of inaction. And sometimes the complete opposite, where we're protecting these horses. Anyway, it's an interesting episode, guys, where I chat with Harrison about how he got started in documentary filmmaking, how his passion for animals and zoology developed, and a great deal more. So, without any further ado, guys, I give you Harrison Warne. Let's get into it. G'day guys, welcome to this episode of Aussie English. Today I have Harrison Warne on the podcast, who I stumbled across, I guess, online on YouTube recently from seeing your amazing doco on, would you say it's on the horses or the corroboree frog, but it was called Underfrog?
I'd say it's about Kosciuszko National Park.
Okay. So more broadly speaking than any of the individual characters in it.
Yeah, I think so.
Brilliant. So man, where did you grow up? Tell us your story.
I grew up on the far south coast of New South Wales in a small town called Pambula, and went to school in Eden, which is just about 20 kilometres south. When I finished school, I went to Townsville, which is in far north Queensland, and that's where I got my Bachelor of Science, majored in ecology and zoology, and then I came back to the far south coast of New South Wales, and I've been working as an ecologist here ever since, so for 2 years now.
Oh, far out. And so what was that like growing up in Pambula? Because that's right next to Marimbula, right?
Yeah. So it's such a good spot. It's right on the beach, and we've got the Kosciuszko National Park, which is the main spot for skiing in Australia, is 2 hours away. The water here is pretty good for about 4 months of the year. The other 8 months, it gets too cold to swim, but it's still beautiful. And yeah, just pristine beaches. There's not many people here, and the bushland all around us is pretty, you know, it's pretty remarkable. There's nothing else like it.
Is it one of those towns though where the younger generation are dying to leave, or is it one where, you know, because I think an example in Victoria would be somewhere like Shepparton. When I've gone there, it tends to be immigrants and an older generation Australians, because the younger generation tend to go to university or something once they finish school and then they just never return. Has it sort of turned into that kind of a place? Or?
Yeah, it's definitely a retirement town. On the south coast, it's just a string of coastal towns that are pretty close together, and they're all basically retirement towns. High population of older people, and then, you know, you get your working class families and the young ones, but yeah, there's definitely a lack of people in their 20s in the area, that's for sure.
I feel you. I live in Ocean Grove, so that's right on the mouth of the Port Phillip Bay, the opening to Port Phillip Bay, and I was in Melbourne for 10 years studying at university, which felt very young.
You go home and there's two young people left in town.
Yeah. Well, I moved in with my wife into a house that's 100 metres away from where I grew up with my folks. And we had our first child. But you realise when you leave the house, you're like, oh my God, the average age of people in Ocean Grove is probably 50.
Yeah.
It is a bit of a shock. So what was it like going from Pambula to Townsville? Was it a big change, or was it much the same, just a higher latitude?
It's completely different. So I'll never forget the first moment I stepped off the plane out of the airport and into the air there. was just like stepping into a sauna. It was just, it was about 36 degrees, 90% humidity. And I knew that I'd made the right decision, but I knew it was going to be hard to adapt.
How long did it take?
To adapt?
Yeah, because I know that like the humidity, I think it causes you to sweat a lot more when you've grown up in a colder climate, right? Initially, and it takes weeks to get used to it.
Yeah, well, what I found was the strangest thing was how bright the sun was.
Mm.
And it's something that I never even thought about, but I'd be crossing the road at a zebra crossing and I would be blinded just because of how bright the white strips were. And it's just small things like that. But where I lived for the first year, I didn't have air conditioning. So that kind of forces you to get used to the heat very quickly.
Oh, Jesus. No aircon. My God.
Yeah. Yeah. But the next 2 years I had aircon, so I got a bit softer then.
I remember I did turtle research at Bundaberg, and then we went to Rain Island 1 year, which is, I guess it's what, Port Jackson, further north, up near the tip. Yeah,
way off.
Yeah. But we had to go through where it would have been Cairns, and then we drove up. But I remember just every year, you know, so I would come from Geelong or Melbourne and have to go all the way north, and I would pack normal clothes and then get out there, and you just never use anything more than shorts, thongs and a singlet or something, right? Because it's just, it's so hot and humid all the time. I miss pants. I missed having jumpers. Was it a bit like that?
Oh, yeah. No, totally. I would pump the aircon just to put my jumper on sometimes. But you adapt quickly. And the other thing is we would go to the rainforest a lot, and we would up there. It's actually quite a lot colder because you go from about 300 meters above sea level to 1,100 meters where we'd normally go. And it was pretty cold there, especially in winter. So we would rug up then, and it was a good excuse to put a jumper back on and feel that again. Yeah.
So was that the draw for you to go to Townsville? Was it the fact that there's so much awesome wildlife there, rainforests and everything?
Yeah, honestly, the only reason I went up there was because I really wanted to see crocodiles in the wild.
And how was it? How long did it take and before you crossed paths with one?
Oh, a few weeks, yeah.
Yeah.
So where the university is in Townsville, James Cook University, it's about a 10-minute walk to the Ross River, where there's a population of freshwater crocodiles. So we'd go down there spotlighting at night and see water pythons and freshwater crocs and heaps of different fish in the river as well. So yeah, it didn't take long at all. And probably 3 months in, we bought a little blow up boat. So we'd go on the river and we'd just row down and we'd be spotlighting and trying to find crocs. And if we found a small one, sometimes we'd even catch it. And yeah, it was good fun.
So do you have to be worried about saltwater crocs though in the Ross River?
So the Ross River is separated by three weirs.
Okay.
And under the last weir is saltwater. So there are saltwater crocodiles there, but because there's a barrier to get up into the freshwater bit, then no, there's no salties up further than that.
So far out, man. I would be crapping myself, I think, either way, if I was just in case I made a mistake and got into the wrong.
You're always wary. You've got to be switched on up there.
So did you see any of the stories of people getting attacked or taken by crocs up in Queensland whilst you were there? And were there sort of clear reasons why that tends to happen to certain people?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, you'd see people that were fishing right on the coast, and the water up there is always dirty as well because there's so much agricultural runoff, big rainfall and heaps of runoff. So the water is constantly murky. So and people just sit right on the coastline, sit on the rocks. And yeah, even when I was up there, a fisherman did get lunged at by a salty.
Jesus.
But no one got fatally attacked when I was there. But you can see how it happens, and people just don't think about it as well.
So you think they get complacent?
Oh, for sure. You'll be on the beach there and there'll be a family with kids, and the kids will be running down to the waves in the water. Even though a kilometre up the beach, there'll be like a fully sectioned off area for people to swim in, which is, you know, which is a croc and a stinger barrier. So yeah, definite complacency, but also just a lack of respect, I guess. And probably a lack of understanding. I think if people saw what the crocodiles were capable of, they would probably stand back a few meters from the water and there'd be less incidents.
Man, I remember when we were going to Rain Island, I was crapping myself. I was terrified because we, you know, I've never grown up anywhere where there were predators like that are so dangerous, but also pretty conspicuous and you can see them. Like, you know, we might have the odd great white shark attack down here in Victoria on the southern coast, but you would never have crocs. But up in Queensland, when we were going up there, you'd see them on the beach, you'd see their footprints, and you would just have to be so switched on and aware in some of these places. And I remember having one of the guys carrying a gun out and about whilst we were walking along the beaches doing turtle stuff. And that was when it sort of sunk in. I was like, holy shit. Because one of the guys, I remember he, especially with the dead carcasses, right, of all the turtles that come up on the beach and they die, especially Rain Island had that year 8,000 turtles a night coming up on tiny little sand island. And obviously you get tiger sharks and crocodiles attracted to the dead animals. And he was like, one year I was walking too close to the water and a croc just ran out at me and I had to just like bail.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, it terrifies me. Did you hear that story about that guy that was trying to impress the British chick and jumped off the pier into the water?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was a classic. Yeah, I was up there when that happened. And I'd driven past that river the day before and I'd said to my mate who I was up there doing a filming trip at the time, and I said to him, hey, see if there's any crocs. Like, they've got to be some crocs in there. And then the next day, that's when that guy got attacked by that croc. So,
do you remember the story? Do you want to tell the listeners what happened?
There was a local man from Ingham, no, from Innisfail, sorry, in Innisfail, which is just south of Cairns, and he was trying to show off to a backpacker.
Yeah,
and so he jumped in the water and
drunk, right?
Yeah, he was drunk as well. He was off his face, so he jumped into the water Yeah, not long after, a croc grabbed him, but he was fine. He just had some stitches, I think, but he was fine.
He broke his arm, I thought.
Oh, well, there you go. Not too fine, but
he survived.
Statistically, if you jump in with a croc, well, you're obviously not going to jump in if you know there's a croc there, but if you jump in with a croc that's over 4 meters, statistically, you're already dead.
Really?
So there's 0% chance of survival. Yeah.
Far out.
So if it's over 4 meters, you're gone.
Because there's a famous zoo owner or zookeeper, right, who got his hand taken or at least smashed up recently. Because I saw him, and I think it was complacency again. He was on 60 Minutes or something talking about it, and I think he had a bush pig's leg and had thrown it to the croc, and something had got caught on the bottom of the croc's mouth. So he just thought, I'll walk up and brush it away with my hand, and the croc just grabbed it.
Yeah.
Went into the death roll and took him into the water, and luckily he got away. But yeah, I can't imagine. I think Crocodile Dundee scares most Aussies, right, into respecting the water and just staying away from the edge.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you see a crocodile in the wild and you just see it slowly submerge itself, you just get an idea of how amazing they are as a predator, like just absolute perfection in the water.
Because they haven't changed, right, in hundreds of millions of years.
Yeah, millions of years, pretty much unchanged. So, yeah, they're insane and such a beautiful thing to see as well. When you're on a boat out there in the river with one and you're just looking at one and it just disappears and you think it could be anywhere right now, like that just demands respect.
Well, and don't they float right on the surface, and the only part of their body that's above the water will be what their nostrils and their eyes, right? It's like the head is flat with the water and the rest of the body kind of goes a bit under so nothing can see them.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, just their nose so they can breathe. It's just insane.
So what was it like at the beach there too compared to Pambula? Because I imagine that the coastline is different in a number of different ways in terms of animals there as well as the geography.
Yeah, so the water there is pretty much always dirty, which was the probably the most disappointing thing for me, moving from somewhere where the water is pretty much, you know, good 5-6 meter visibility, if not better, all year round. And then you go up there and the water's just brown all year round. Yeah, that was quite disappointing.
And that's just runoff in the river, is it?
Yeah,
that's just coming out into the ocean.
So they grow heaps of sugar cane up there, and And most of North Queensland gets a lot of rain, and that just so that's just runoff from the agriculture. A lot of beef farm up there as well. So, but they have been trying to implement a lot of measures to try and control that, because we know that it does quite negatively impact the reef. We think that it causes more crown of thorns starfish to bloom.
And why are they a problem? Why are crown of thorns starfish a problem?
Yeah, so the crown of thorns starfish is a naturally occurring starfish on the reef, but in for some reason over the last 40, 50 or so years, there's been basically blooms of these guys. Like they'll just go crazy. So there'll just be thousands of them in single reef areas, and they eat the coral. So, you know, straight off, that's just it's a pretty big blow to the coral. And then you add other elements, such as dirty water, which reduces the sunlight so they can't photosynthesize. You get cyclones and warmer water, and it's just all these smaller factors which play a part and really damage the reef. But we think it's related to the runoff from the agricultural water, but it hasn't fully been proven yet as far as I know.
So is it like localized that they have all those crown of thorns starfish really close to where the river is and the runoff is, but the further out into pristine environments you go on the reef, there's fewer of them?
I'm actually not sure, but I would assume that it's probably like that, yeah.
All right. So what was it like going there and obviously being able to snorkel and scuba dive and go and check out the reef? Is the reef doing well at the moment, or you want to tell us a story there?
Yeah. So the first time I went to the reef, I'd been up there for 6 months, and I went off Green Island, which is a very popular tourist place, off Cairns. I think it's about 18 kilometers off the coast, probably less than that. And the first time I went there, I was just blown away. Like, yeah. Amazing coral, heaps of fish, heaps of turtles. And the island is really well kept for how many tourists go there. Didn't see any damaged coral. It was all really nice. And then I went back the exact same time the next year, and it was bleached and heaps of dead coral. And it was like, it just broke my heart seeing that.
So what happens when coral is bleached? What's the problem?
So when coral bleaches, it's stressed. Basically, a bleached coral is a stressed coral. And what happens is the coral will kick out the symbiotic algae that it has in its tissue. We don't know why they do that. It's just a factor of stress, which is usually caused by heat in these cases when we see the mass bleaching on the Great Barrier Reef. And if the coral is able to reabsorb those algae, then it'll usually survive and be okay. But sometimes the coral can't, and it'll slowly starve to death, and that's when you see large areas of reef dead and damaged, and just in general, it reduces the coral diversity, and reduced coral diversity means there's less fish habitat and less fish diversity and less invertebrate diversity, and it's a real trickle down effect for the reef.
Did they give you much of an idea of what lays ahead in the future too, in terms of the health of the reef and climate change when you were studying at JCU?
Yeah. So when I was up there, there was two major bleaching incidents. And the second one was when Dr. Terry, can't remember his last name now off the top of my head, but he was all through the media, and he's a James Cook University researcher. And they made it sound like it's somewhat doom and gloom if we don't lift our game in terms of tackling climate change. So, yeah, and when you see it bleached as well, it is really depressing. It can bounce back, and we've seen it bounce back in a lot of places. But in saying that, I'm not a marine scientist, so... I'm just speculating here, and I know that they're doing a lot of research into how to make coral a bit more resistant. So they're selectively breeding the coral, which does better in higher temperatures. So
yeah.
So that could be one way that we can hopefully improve coral into the future. But yeah, there's massive grants at the moment into looking into coral, and I'm not sure where that's going to go, but I'm sure it's going to be exciting wherever it ends up.
Yeah. So how did you end up falling in love with nature and obviously pursuing that as a career?
That's just been me for as long as I know. There's photos of me when I was really young on the beach picking up pippies, and there's one of me when I was like 3 years old lifting up a rock in the garden.
Yeah.
With a really dorky bowl cut haircut. and apparently I was looking for lizards then. So I've also been told by my babysitter that I used to make her get down on her hands and knees and find frogs with me in the garden. So it's all I've known, really.
It sounds a lot like my childhood too.
Yeah.
So did you get that from your parents or anything? Did they encourage that, or you just had an innate interest?
It's just a curiosity, really, that I guess turned into an obsession, but I don't know, more of a lifestyle than an obsession, I'd say. Yeah, there's something fascinating in the way that things move, I think, and just constant that the fact that you don't know what you're going to find when you go out in the bush is
it's like Pokemon in real life, right?
That's right. That's the best way to describe it. Like, you find a log, you don't know what's going to be under that log. Sometimes there's nothing, but hey, sometimes there's a really nice lizard or snake or frog, or and that's what really was driving it when I got a bit older, as a teenager as well, just that the fact that there's so much more to see and find. So yeah,
crazy. I remember that too. I remember we used to go to my grandparents' farm near Bendigo, and I'd always be lifting up rocks and finding geckos and scorpions. And one year I remember I went when it was summer, lifted up a rock, and there was a baby brown snake under the rock, and I was like, oh my God. But my family was like, we got to go. Yeah. And then we came back in winter, and I literally got out of the car, went to the same rock, lifted it up, and the thing was still there, but like so cold it couldn't move. Got a stick, put it in a bucket, and brought it inside that morning to everyone. And everyone was pretty nonplussed. They were not happy. But
it's a classic story, that one, isn't it?
Exactly.
I think most little reptile boys have done that as well.
Man, I assume there's a whole heap of really cool reptiles around Pambula and Eden and everything too, right?
Yeah. Well, because we're kind of the end of the East Coast here, we kind of trail off on what you get a bit further north. We're also not sandstone country here, which has really good diversity for reptiles. So once you get about 300 kilometers north of here, you kind of get into the Nowra area where the sandstone starts. Lots of really cool reptiles up there. But down here, because we're quite far south, not quite as many reptiles, but yeah, still some really interesting stuff, like lots of really nice snakes. We've got death adders and diamond pythons, which are two of my favorite snakes, and they're both fairly easy to find if you know where to look. So, and it keeps surprising me. Like last week I was driving and I found a golden crown snake, which is nuts because it's the one of only three sightings south of Nowra as well. So,
and the
most southern record of that species by 50 kilometers. So that was really super cool. Yeah. And it just, that really highlights how little we really know about this area. I think there's still a lot of research to do. I think that's because we're quite far away from any city. We're kind of a 7-hour drive from Sydney and Melbourne. So it's a long way for a researcher to go. But yeah, I think there's still so much to learn about this little pocket down here.
Yeah, it was beautiful. I was doing, for masters, when I was studying lace monitors, I was doing the work out in, I think it's Conra. Where is it? It's in East Gippsland.
Cape Conran?
Yeah, Conran, sorry. Yeah, and it was like a good 6-hour drive to get out there, but so beautiful. And it was always like, man, people should just come and live here. But then you realize, yeah, but it's 6 hours from the city or from, you know, any substantial city. Is that why you fell in love with photography and filmmaking as well?
Yeah. So I remember really clearly the first time that I appreciated photography, and I was out west in central western New South Wales with a bunch of friends, and I was out there and I'd never been that far west before. So there was all these really cool reptiles that I'd never seen. There was shinglebacks and spiny-tailed geckos and all kinds of crazy things. And I was just taking photos of them because I wanted to get back and show my friends and my family back home. And I got back and they're all like, wow, these are actually really good. And I got them up on my laptop and I was like, oh yeah, that actually is pretty cool. Like, I got a photo of a shingleback and it's just really nicely framed, and it's at quite a low level, and it's got its tongue out and its mouth open, and it's a pretty cool behavior. It's pretty standard, but yeah, looking back now for how old I was, I can't remember how old I was, but, yeah, pretty cool. And just, that was just with a little point and shoot camera. So I got back from that, and a lot of people said nice things about the photos. So every time I went out in the bush after that, I had my camera with me, and then my love for photography just grew and grew and grew. And I naturally transitioned from catching things to taking photos of things. So I was very hands-on when I was younger with the animals that I would find. And then as I transitioned into photography, I became much less hands-on and very animal-orientated. So it would be all about keeping a safe distance, letting them do what they're doing and just admiring them, and also trying to capture them in a way which makes the animal look as nice as possible and quite, I guess, quite artistic as well.
Yeah. How do you go about that? So do you want to talk about, like, if you're going to go out there and photograph animals, especially if they're reptiles, more cryptic kind of animals, they must be a lot harder. I mean, I do some photography of birds and stuff because my dad got me into that when I was a bit younger. And there I realized people don't do birds because they freaking love birds. They do birds because they're the most conspicuous and easy to find animal. You know, they're the ones flying around everywhere, doing action, making movements and you know, calling. But yep. If I could photograph snakes and lizards all the time, I would, but they tend to be so difficult to find. Yep. So how do you go about that? If you want to go out and you want to photograph some snakes and some lizards, how would that differ from wanting to photograph birds?
Yes. Yeah, so as you said, they're much harder to find. In general, the best way is to go out at night usually. So we'll go out, we will drive the roads, road cruising. And then when we find something, we'll stop. If it's a snake that's on the road or a lizard that's on the road, we'll move it off the road and then we photograph it, which is a pretty good way to do it. Still a bit intrusive, but in another way, you're getting it off the road, which is potentially saving it as well. We try to be a bit more careful when we're in the bush. And I don't know, it's quite hard to find things in general. A lot of the time it's just luck and knowing what kind of habitat species prefer. So we'll, go to a certain place with a certain species in mind. And if we find that, then hopefully we can photograph it. But yeah, reptiles, especially in summer, are really difficult because they're super fast. They can just disappear in a split second.
The interesting thing seems to be that reptile photographers seem to use wide angle lenses, which suggests you've got to get bloody close to get them full frame in the camera, right? Whereas bird photographers, it's like, yeah, we just slap on a 600 mil lens and you can take a photo from 50 meters away and the thing's full frame. So how do you go about trying to get that close to animals that are so cryptic, so skittish anyway?
Yep. So a lot of the times the photographers that do that have kind of set a scene in their head. So they'll position the animal where they want it. Everyone that does that is fully trained and qualified as well.
Don't go out there and start picking up snakes and trying to place them on branches and take photos without knowing what you're doing.
No, please don't. It's a very easy way to get bitten.
Well, actually, I'm a massive fan of, I've forgotten his surname, Ross.
Ross McGibbon.
McGibbon, there you go. Yeah. He was on the podcast previously, but he's probably Australia's best venomous snake photographer.
Yeah, for sure.
And he was telling me the story of getting bitten by a taipan because he got too blasé, got too close to it, and it just grabbed his hand. Mm. So even the experts can get taken. Yep. He was like, yeah, I could have died.
Yeah, and especially when you're focusing on the photo.
Yes.
Then it's really easy because you're looking through the screen and that doesn't really give you a good idea of distance from the animal as well, especially when you're using a wide angle. So
there's two centimeters.
Exactly. And it's nothing. So, and a snake, like you're photographing a death adder up close, that thing can strike 8 times in a second. Like,
yeah.
It's bitten you before you even know what's happened.
Are you wearing gloves? Steel gloves?
No. Some people I've seen, they have a bit of a shield on their camera, which is a good idea. My style, personally, I prefer to use more of a zoom, and I don't really photograph too much at night. I find the flashes a bit annoying, but kind of more of a zoom because I quite like the shallow depth of field that you can get.
That compression, right?
Yeah. Especially I like to get a bit of a blurry foreground and then a nice smooth background. And then I like to have the animal perfectly in focus there, but it completely depends on what I'm photographing as well.
It's such a cool kind of, well, it's a profession, but for me, it's a hobby. It's such a cool hobby, right? Because you don't realize how much goes into getting the right photo with working out your foreground, working out your background, working out the subject, working out the light, the timing, using the device correctly. Like, it's, there's so much to it that becomes addictive, right?
Yeah, for sure. But the thing I've noticed as well is you don't think about it. You do it for a certain amount of time and you just don't think about it. Then it just becomes second nature. So I'll be photographing a frog and I'll kind of move myself in a position where the frog is at a certain size in the frame, the fern is a certain distance in the background, and then the lighting comes in from a certain aspect. So it just kind of happens second nature after a while. And I think that's pretty cool when you can kind of just flow with your subject as well. So you need to kind of be able to move yourself so that you're interfering with the animal the least amount, because really if you're moving an animal around and you're interfering with it, then its chances of stressing out is way higher. Its chances of getting damaged is higher. And really, if you do that, then it's kind of not the point of wildlife photography.
Does it become a fine line? Does it become very difficult to decide when to stop too? Because I can imagine when you're behind the camera, you're just like, oh man, one more photo. You know, this one was good, but I'm sure I can get better. But you have to take into account the animal and its situation too, right?
Yeah. And I think that comes from respecting your subject as well. I kind of think about it more as a time frame. So if I've been with the animal for a certain amount of time, I know that it's been too long, I'll just pack up and leave. If I don't have the shot, I don't have the shot. That's on me, really.
Good attitude to have. So was it photography that led you into filmmaking and making documentaries?
Yeah, definitely. But also a bit of an anger, especially with the horse film. Film is a fairly easy transition to make from photography, but it's not necessarily an easy thing to do. Filmmaking is kind of like you have to build yourself a jigsaw, which is three-dimensional, and you have to build all of the pieces yourself and you have to build them out of order. Whereas photography is a bit more straightforward than that.
It is a bit of a nightmare, right? Because I remember you watch movies and TV series like Game of Thrones or whatever, and you don't realize that the way in which it's been filmed is probably completely out of sequence, and then later they have to go in and put it into order. So as you say, the same sort of thing with a documentary film, something like with, you know, David Attenborough or whatever, running through the jungle. It's never just he went here, then he went there, then he went there. It's always, you know, we're going to send you to all these places, get the photography, get the video, and then we'll string it into a story, right?
Yeah, exactly. You have to be able to think from the very start to the very end, and then editing.
Yeah.
But you also need to be prepared to have everything go wrong as well.
Yep. So how did you plan out Underfrog, which was the one I saw? Is that your most recent film?
Yep. So Underfrog came out this time last year.
Yep.
Yeah. So with planning was quite simple. I just had an idea. And I would just write notes every day, scripts, shots that I wanted, how it was going to flow, that kind of thing. So I had a pretty good storyboard in my head before I went out.
Yep.
But the reality of that was fairly different. A lot of it was how I wanted it, but once you've got everything and you're at the end of filming and then you're kind of looking at it, then you realize that things look better in some, you know, in a completely different order. So there was an event up there called Narjong, which was an indigenous traditional ceremony up there. And that was the very last thing we filmed. And that's the very start of the film. And I didn't even know this event was going on. So to have that happen and then to put that as the start of the film, that just completely threw things out of whack in terms of the storyboard. But for the film, it made it flow much, much better.
Yeah. So you have to really be good at maintaining that level of flexibility where you have a certain thing in mind, but you also have to be like, if something comes up along the way, we got to try and implement it or incorporate it so that we end up with an even better product.
Yeah, for sure. And when you're out there filming and something happens, you kind of, in your head, you shuffle things around and you can insert certain things that you've just filmed or whatever's going on. You can kind of, in your head, you can insert that into the storyboard as well. So say there's, like I said, the traditional ceremony there. when we were there, I knew straight away that this was going to be the perfect introduction to the film because of the context of what was going on.
Yep.
Right there and then, I knew that that was where that was going to be. So, yeah, so definitely flexibility, but also quite, you have to be quite switched on. I think you have to be able to know what is and what isn't going to work, but also it's such a frustrating process because you'll be out there filming for days and days and days and you'll get 30 seconds of film that you can use. So
I was about to ask, you know, you will see the documentary and it goes for about 30 minutes, right? Yep. Maybe a little bit less. And yep. you have no real sense of how much effort and time would have gone into it. What was it like trying to put it together? And, you know, did you have certain situations where you ended up spending hours capturing, you know, what turned out to be a few seconds, but was vital for the film?
Yeah, so the first filming trip I did was in October of 2018.
Yep.
And then the last filming trip was in March 2019. So a fair few months in between there, and I was working full time as well, so I could only go up weekends, or if I got a day off, if I was really lucky, I could go up and be there for two nights. Usually it was just weekends stint, so, and it's a 4-hour drive to most of the places where I filmed. So yeah, it is a long process. And what was the other part of the question? Sorry.
Well, I guess were there certain situations where you spent hours and hours in the field trying to collect just a small snippet that was then, you know, put in the documentary that was vital? Because I imagine some of these animals are so difficult to find. And when you do find them, you get a fleeting couple of seconds or so to actually photograph them or take some film of them.
Yeah. So some things, like, we'd be there for hours trying to find certain things and we would, nothing from that would end up in the film.
Yeah.
So, for example, the corroboree frog, which I really, really wanted to find for the film, that was going to be a vital piece for the film and never found one the whole time.
Do you want to talk about that frog and why it's so charismatic and well-known in Australia?
Yeah, right. So the northern corroboree frog, there's two species of corroboree frog, the southern and the northern. And the northern lives in the northern part of Kosciuszko National Park and just across the border into Nemadji National Park, which is part of the ACT. These frogs used to be absolutely, they used to just proliferate, like, they were everywhere in the snowy mountains. So when explorers first arrived there, they said these frogs would just jump from under their feet, like just thousands and thousands of them. It's estimated that they had the largest amount of biomass out of everything in the Australian snowy mountains. So
no kidding.
So there used to be an absolute bucket of them. But then in the 70s, chytrid fungus, amphibian chytrid fungus, was accidentally introduced to Australia. And the species down south species in colder climates seem to be hit a lot harder by amphibian chytrid fungus. So probably, yeah. So we had six extinctions in Australia from this disease. And then lots and lots of species were hit really hard, populations extinct, populations critical. And that's including both corroboree frog species. So
was the gastric brooding frog one of those that got completely wiped out and went extinct? Yep. And these guys were really cool frogs because they ate their eggs, right? And then had their babies hatch inside them and they would keep them safe inside of their, I guess, stomach and mouth.
Yeah. And then they'd basically regurgitate their, a small frog, which resembled an adult, but it was just much, much smaller.
Yeah. Hence the name gastric brooding frog,
which is incredible. And, such a sad thing to lose. We also lost a few frogs in the wet tropics, and just a couple of other species that are really cool, and it's really sad that they're not around anymore. But at the time, no one knew what was happening. These frogs were just dying everywhere. And it wasn't until Lee Berger, who's a researcher up in North Queensland, she got a sample of one of these frogs, a tissue sample, and then she got it under the microscope and she saw that it was a fungus that was doing this to the frogs. So, yeah, really sad. And it's wiped out hundreds of species of frogs right around the world. So, it's the most dangerous disease ever recorded, actually.
In terms of driving animals to extinction.
Yep. Yep. Which is insane.
I guess it's a good transition too to the problem of invasive species. So chytrid fungus is obviously a fungus that's sort of like a disease that infects animals and kills them. But we also have things like horses in the Kosciuszko National Park that are a massive problem that the average person doesn't really appreciate, right, how much damage they're doing. So can you talk a bit about the problem with horses in Kosciuszko National Park?
Yeah, so horses have been in Kosciuszko National Park for about 200-ish years. Probably not quite that many. They're in the park for a number of different reasons. And until the last kind of three decades, they were in pretty low numbers, like around in the hundreds, like low hundreds, so 300, 400. And then as their distribution has expanded to the north and to the south, their numbers have just boomed. So it's estimated that there's over 20,000 horses now in Kosciuszko National Park. And that's, they're not distributed across the whole park. So they're in sections. And where they are, it's very, very obvious they're there. There's just piles of horse dung everywhere. And then you look at the creeks and the creeks are just absolutely destroyed. So you see most of the creeks there now, just their banks are just sheer eroded banks, and it's really sad to see. But the thing is, Kosciuszko National Park has really soft soil, especially in the north, and that's where there's these hundreds of thousands of year old bogs up there, which is lined with sphagnum moss, and it's really critical habitat. It's a critically endangered ecological community, and you get a heavy-bodied animal up there like a horse or a deer, and it walks through that, and then you times that by a couple of thousand, then you've just got a muddy mess, and it just completely changes the hydrology of the area and destroys habitat, and yeah, it's really quite messy.
That was one of the tragic parts, I think, of your documentary, was obviously showing the damage that the horses do to these environments that affects, I think you were showing Galaxia fish, one of these small fish that live in these, you know, tributaries to rivers and everything, right? And they're very restricted distributions, so that if you wipe out one valley, you could kill an entire species.
Yep. So, yeah, so the fish in the film is called the Stocky Galaxus, and it's only found in 2 kilometres of this creek.
Yeah, insane.
And the reason it's only in these 2 kilometres is because there's a waterfall under the creek, which has stopped trout getting up, which is another big problem. They would have been distributed throughout the whole area, but
trout are another species that were introduced, yeah. Right?
Trout, yeah. So there's I think there's 3 species of trout in the national park, and they just eat anything that fits in their mouth. So they've smashed the Galaxus fish anywhere underneath this waterfall. They can't get above the waterfall. And so it's the last place that these fish live. And so the horses, where the fish are, it's a very high density area of horses. And horses are basically drawn to water. So wherever there's creeks, wherever there's swamps, there's going to be horses, and you can very, very clearly see the tracks that the horses have made through the creeks, many, many crossings across the creeks, and they've just completely denuded the vegetation there. So,
yeah.
And the impact that has on the fish is that it puts silt in the water, and the silt goes and fills up the cracks which the fish need for breeding. So the fish, they'll lay their eggs under these rocks. And it also gets rid of the vegetation, which attract insects, which the fish feed on. So it has a massive cascading effect. And the other thing is this big fire has just gone right through the national park in the last few months. So, and that's around this creek area. So the horses are still there. They were basically untouched by this fire. And now there's a lot less vegetation. So there's going to be a lot more erosion. This fish is only found in 2 kilometres of this creek, and the government has protected a feral species, which is destroying.
Can you talk about that and why that happened, or how that's happened, and the effect it's having?
Yeah, it's a kind of a typical problem where there's some stakeholders who profit from from horse trail riding. And one of their main points which get people there is, we will take you horse riding to see wild horses. And so the person or people who own this business used to be in politics and have good friends in politics. And so as far as I understand it, this person has written up some legislation which has gone to Parliament and been passed, which is called the Brumby Heritage Bill, which basically protects horses in Kosciuszko National Park. And there was a scientific committee, and it's outraged a lot of people. But it's just one of those things where people don't understand how this is going to impact a number of species that are found nowhere else on the planet. So
especially if it remains unchecked, right? You don't have culls going past, you know, because like with the camels that we've seen recently, you know, if you don't control the numbers, they go nuts and they end up being a massive problem for species, even humans. So what would you ideally see happen then with the horses?
Well, same as any feral species, they don't belong there. Like, you can see horses in every continent except Antarctica.
Well, the ironic thing there, sorry to interrupt you, the ironic thing that you were saying is that people are going horse riding to see other horses.
Yeah.
And it's
that's right.
You're on the attraction. You just want to see wild horses.
And you're allowed to have your horses in Kosciuszko National Park as well. There's camps that are set up just for people who want to go there and ride their horses through the park, which that's fine. But the fact that these people are lobbying to have a feral species, especially a feral species which number in the tens of thousands now, these horses, they're listed as a key threatening factor to the Kosciuszko National Park under the Biodiversity Conservation Act.
Yep.
So they've basically gone and protected a key threatening activity, a key threatening process.
It'd be like protecting coronavirus at the moment, right?
That's it. Yeah, exactly.
We can't wipe it out. There's too many people who want to go horse riding in the park and see coronavirus in the wild.
Yeah. And it's just crazy because if people went a bit deeper into the national park off the Snowy Mountains Highway and just went for a walk in any of those creeks, especially in the north, they will see those creeks are just absolutely destroyed. But the horse groups are they're very smart and they're very good at, I guess, kind of twisting it. They'll say, what about the deer? What about the pigs?
Yeah.
What about the four-wheel drives? But at the end of the day, these horses, and we know this because there's been huge amounts of science huge amounts of science invested into Kosciuszko National Park for decades and decades now. Horses have the largest impact on anything in the park.
Exactly. So why would you start with lesser impact problems, right?
Yeah,
so it's don't worry about coronavirus because we have this really rare form of cancer that's also killing people. What about that one? You know, let's take care of that first.
But yeah, instead they go and protect what's causing this damage. So it's quite a backwards move, and it angered a lot of people, especially in the scientific community. A lot of people are very angry. So it's been 4 years now, and there's still a lot of anger about that. So I guess the point of the film, though, isn't about that. It doesn't look at the politics. It doesn't look at how people feel about the issue. It is about the park and what's there now and what we have to protect.
Yeah.
So the film looks at the landscapes. It looks at the corroboree frog, and it looks at the stocky galaxus. And I guess the main point of the film is that we need to prioritize the natural heritage of the park over absolutely everything else.
Exactly. Well, and I thought that was why it was such a good film, and I wanted to get you on the podcast, because it doesn't seem to be that side of these sorts of stories involving our natural environments, especially with pest species, doesn't often tend to be talked about and shown. So is that what drew you towards wanting to make this film?
Yeah, well, I spent quite a lot of time up in the Snowies. I've got a mate, I'm going to leave him nameless, but he's a ranger up there, and on his spare time, he would take me for driving some of the ranger tracks and take me into some of the places where no one ever goes, and there would be horse damage there.
Yeah.
And for a long time, they were talking about doing something about the horses. And when they actually start talking about doing something proactive, 2 weeks later, the bill gets passed. And that just set a fire inside of me, which told me that I needed to make a film about what's going on up here because it is unacceptable at every level.
It's a good film and I recommend that you guys go and check it out, Underfrog, on YouTube, and I'll link it in the transcript. Before we go, last question. How did you end up with a leech in your eye?
So that was part of my last film called Life in the Wet, and I was up there filming rain up in the rainforest in North Queensland, and I had to film rain for this certain part of the sequence, and I just it was a torrential, like downpour was torrential. It was absolutely bucketing down, and I just gone back to the car because if I'd stayed out any longer, it would have destroyed all of my gear, and I just gone back to the car, and I saw a little black thing on my face, and I didn't know it was a leech at the time because I'd kind of only just seen it out of my peripheral vision, and I put my camera gear down and I looked back up and it was gone, and it kind of was in my head that that was probably a leech, but I wasn't 100% sure, and leeches don't fall off, like they just don't fall off.
Yeah.
So I knew that if it was a leech.
You've got to explain what a leech is, right? It's a sort of invertebrate.
Yeah, and they suck blood. So they've got two. They've got a mouth on either end. They inject an anticoagulant into your blood, and they basically just drink you until they're full. Drop off.
Yeah.
And sometimes you don't even know they're there. They're so good at latching on without you feeling anything. And yeah, so this leech, it had obviously crawled across my face and gone under my eyelid, and I had a suspicion that that's what had happened, but I wasn't 100% sure yet. So I was checking my eye and it had stopped raining. So I went back out and did a bit more filming, probably about 10 minutes, got back to the car and I could feel something. And so I lifted up my eyelid and there was this big bulge at the back of my eyelid near my nose there. And and it was a small leech. So it was full. Like it was basically a little circle by this point. It was so full of blood. And I didn't have to do much. I just had to kind of put my finger above it and press down and it just fell off. But it was a pretty unreal experience, and you hear people telling stories like that and you just think, oh, that's disgusting. But then it happens to you and you're like, damn, this is really cool.
Yeah. They freak me out. Ever since I was a kid at my grandparents' farm, their ponds always had these horse leeches, which were like, you know, 8 inches long with stripes. And I just always used to be like, Jesus Christ.
So the ones up there, they're only a couple of centimeters, which is really good because they're everywhere, but they're not very big, which is great.
They're not going to leave you anemic,
south,
right?
Yeah, that's it. The ones down south are quite a bit bigger. So yeah. It was an interesting experience, but and I filmed the whole thing. So
exactly. Well, I saw the video on Facebook, so go check out Harrison Warne on Harrison Warne Photography, right?
Wildlife Photography. Yeah,
Harrison Warne Wildlife Photography on Facebook and Instagram to see that video. But I remember walking through the forest one time when we were doing field work in I think the Blue Mountains looking for lace monitors, and it started raining, and all of a sudden the leaves started moving like they had hairs on them, and you look down and notice, oh my god, there's leeches like on all of these plants, putting their heads up trying to grab onto anything that comes past, and you're just like, oh my god, like they're on me. I can feel them on me. Anyway, man, Harrison Warne, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it, mate. So where can people find out more about you?
So as you said, I've got a Facebook page, which is Harrison Warne Wildlife Photography, and I've also got an Instagram, which is Harrison Warne Photography. I'm about to start a new film project, so if you're interested in that, just come over to my my socials, and there'll be a lot happening very soon after all these restrictions are lifted. So,
can you tell us
ahead? I hope.
Can you tell us anything about what it's going to be about?
Yeah, so back up to North Queensland, which is a really amazing place, especially for it's a biodiversity hotspot, so heaps of animals there. There's a few mountains up there, which are super special because they only have... So these mountains, they are really tall. And because rainforests stay unchanged for hundreds of thousands of years, these species can adapt to tiny little niches. And so these mountains, they have species that are found only in a really small range on the mountains. So, for example, there's a species of frog that is only found from 800 to 1,000 meters above sea level on this one mountain. But there's mountains up there with, a handful of species that are like that. So the film's going to be looking at one of the mountains, which is called Mount Elliot, which has very little science, very little scientific research happen there. There's 5 species of reptile and amphibian there, which are found nowhere else in the world. Just this tiny little pocket of rainforest up the top, really special. We'll be the first people up there to film and show everyone else these species, which is really exciting. And it'll also be talking about climate change and how climate change impacts these species that are on these mountains, because essentially these mountains are like islands. Once these species get to a certain height, they can't go anywhere.
Yeah, can't go down, can't go up.
That's it. It's either too cold or too hot for them. With climate change, they'll be able to go up, but there's only so much mountain for them to go up. And so, this film's going to be exploring that as well as looking at these species, which there's basically no coverage of them. So, it should be really cool.
Brilliant, dude. When should it be out?
It's very early days at the moment, but hopefully mid next year.
Brilliant. Hopefully. Brilliant. All right. Well, man, Harrison, thanks again.
No, thank you.